we are thinking this morning about different kinds of kings and asking the question, what does a king ride? That's a picture of the projector is struggling this morning, but that is the king in his royal carriage heading maybe ride something like that to the coronation. But I want to ask the question, I want to play a game, say, called Who Gets the Glory? And let's imagine, hypothetically, last Sunday on the Tideway in London, there had been a big rowing competition between two crews, one dressed in a very fetching style of shade of light blue, the other in dark blue. And imagine that the forces of light blue had vanquished the forces of darkness and won a glorious double victory that I am still unreasonably happy about this week. Let's imagine that had happened. Who gets the glory when a sports team wins? In the boat race, who gets the glory? Janice?
The team that won.
The team that won, I like that. Okay, Matthew, what were you going to say?
The team that won.
The team that won. James, what were you going to say? The coaches also get the glory, don't they? Yeah, I like that. There was lots of interviews with the coaches last Sunday. Who else gets glory? They celebrated when they won, didn't they? Because they felt like it was a really glorious moment. Matthew, what were you going to say? The whole team, don't they? Like the Cox got kind of a lot of credit because he did some very brave decisions, and so did actually both Coxes did. But the whole crew worked really hard, and quite a lot of glory goes to the crew that didn't win because they worked really hard. So, Jonas, what were you going to say?
Also, the people who were voting for the team that won.
The team that won, yeah, the team that won. So everyone who... Aaron.
Every member of the university.
Thank you. I totally agree with that. Thank you. Every member of the university gets glory. It's never just a solo effort, is it? When someone wins, I'm told there was a big boxing match last night. I don't follow boxing particularly, but I've watched Rocky Balboa, and you know, there's the press conference afterwards, and whenever a sports person wins, they always say, well, I'd like to thank my mum and for believing in me, and my coach for being there, and my nutritionist, and my sponsors. And it's never a solo effort. All right, let's think about World War II. Who gets the glory for winning World War II? Jesse?
The Allies.
The Allies. The Allies get glory. Yeah, I like that. That's a great answer. Any other thoughts? How might we answer that? Elodie?
The world.
The world. Yeah, so the world breathes a massive sigh of relief. Yeah, absolutely. No, were you going to say something? No? Matthew? No? Okay, so... The side that wins, yeah, but it's never a solo effort, is it? So Churchill tends to get a lot of credit for the way he conducted the war effort, but there's lots of other people. You think of all the soldiers and sailors and airmen who fought in the war from across the world. I'm so sorry the projector's not working because you can't see the splendor of the specially commissioned photo here. This is Harry Potter standing, making a last stand against Voldemort. Who gets the glory for the defeat of Voldemort? There are a lot of hands going. Okay. Jonas, who gets the glory?
Dumbledore.
Dumbledore gets a lot of credit for defeating Voldemort, doesn't he? What about you, Jesse? What do you reckon?
Harry Potter.
Harry does get a lot of glory for defeating Voldemort. But yeah, James, what were you going to say? You get the glory for taking the photo. Yes, let's acknowledge that. Photography rights for the photo. Yes, Matthew. The whole school gets glory, don't they? The whole of Dumbledore's army. Okay, can you see the point I'm making? When someone wins a glorious victory, it's never a solo effort. There's always a team of people behind them. Except when God wins a victory, at which point the glory always goes to him alone. There's a really important phrase in Latin. It's perhaps the most important phrase in all of theology. Soli Deo Gloria. Which means glory goes to God alone. And I want us to see that this morning from Exodus chapter 13 and 14. We've got three kings to look at. One is the first is the king who rides a chariot. And a couple of weeks ago, we thought about a family. I made this family up. It's kind of historical fiction, but it's based on, hopefully none of the events that happened to them are made up. I think I've tried to keep it as close to the Bible as I could. Got a family. The dad is called Ben. He was a slave. He lost his eyesight after a horrible incident with a slave driver a few years ago. He worked in building the pyramids. He's got all kinds of terrible scars on his back from where he suffered as a slave. His His wife, Sarah, had this horrible trauma of seeing her younger brothers killed by Pharaoh when she was young. They've got three kids. They've got Noah, who's 8, Shem, who's 6, and little Rachel, who's 4. They have suffered hugely as slaves, and we left them a couple of weeks ago, standing outside their door after Passover, and little Rachel running her hand down the rough wood of the door, and the blood of that little lamb that she had fallen in love with painted over the doorframe, saying, "Little lamb, I love you. You saved us all." And then the family steps out into the street, and there's a million people headed for the border, leaving behind everything they've ever known, following Moses into the wilderness. And it's all so exciting and so new, and everyone's saying, "I can't believe this." What happens next? Judy, are you happy to read for us? Exodus chapter 13, verses 17 to 22. If you'd like to follow it along in the church Bibles, it's page 71.
Exodus chapter 13, reading from verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road towards the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt, armed for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, because Joseph had made the sons of Israel swear an oath. He had said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up with you from this place. So after leaving Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people.
Thanks, Judy. Isn't that amazing? So the Israelites are there, and you can imagine all these people. No one really knows where they're going. Moses put some marshals in place to send people in the right direction, but they're all heading for the border, and everything looks so strange and so new. And little Rachel turns to her mum and says, "Mum, didn't you tell us we had to pack as light as we could?" And she goes, "Yes." And you said we could only take the things that we really needed, like change of clothes, sun cream, water bottle. "Yes." So, Mum, why are those people carrying a coffin with them? Isn't that a bit... Why are you taking a coffin into a desert? And Rachel says, "I can't believe it. I can't believe we've got to see this. That's Joseph's coffin. 400 years ago, he saved us, but he trusted that God. He knew this day would come. He knew God would come to rescue us. And he made us swear on our lives we would take him with him, that we wouldn't leave him behind. He's coming with us to this land that God has promised." And then Shem, little Shem, has got... he's got much better eyesight than anyone else. He's got phenomenal ability. And he sees something coming in the distance. And it's kind of like a flashing, strange flash. Sorry, Judy, would you mind? I'm so sorry. There we go. This is quite exciting. I'm quite pleased with this. There's this cloud, a huge cloud appearing. And Ben says, "It's what is that?" And he put a T-shirt over their face because there's this dust cloud coming towards. They're not going to be able to breathe. And we thought God was going to protect us from this kind of thing. And then a shout goes up from the Israelites as they realize it is God himself coming in a cloud of a pillar of fire, and as it hurtles towards them, swirls out, pulls out in front, and this pillar of cloud and this pillar of cloud and pillar of fire is going to lead them safely on. So they are moving on. It's incredibly exciting. Everything is new. Everything is different. And something is desperately wrong. And most people haven't realized this, but Ben is just keeping an eye out, and he says, "We're going in circles. We've been around this way, this caravan of a million people. We've walked this way before, and we're on the wrong road. If we were going to Canaan, if we're going to the promised land, we need to take the A432. And we've gone right. We've turned off that ages ago, and we're just walking around in the middle of a desert. We're lost." And Ben's eyesight's not great, but he's been around Egyptians his whole life. He knows there are Egyptians around. There are spies watching them. He just knows they're there behind the rocks on the hills. And his wife, Sarah, says, "Ben, just relax, darling. We're free. We're safe. We're not slaves anymore." And he's just very, very twitchy. He knows something is wrong. Judy, would you be happy to read us chapter 14, verses 1 to 9?
Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to turn back and camp near Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. They are to camp by the sea, directly opposite Baal Zephon. Pharaoh will think the Israelites are wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." So the Israelites did this. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, "What have we done? We have let the Israelites go and have lost their services." So he and his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots, along with all the other chariots of Egypt, with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites, who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi-Hahiroth, opposite Baal Zephon.
Judy, thank you so much. So we are thinking now about the king who rides a chariot. We've had some place names there. We're not entirely sure where everywhere is, but we know that the Israelites set out from Ramesses, they came down to Succoth, and then they may have gone a number of different routes. But the key thing is that we are now, the scene has shifted, we're back in Pharaoh's bunker. He is stomping around, he is shouting, he is swearing, he is kicking anything in his sight. He is beaten, he knows it, he is furious, he is yelling at everyone, "Why on earth did you let the Israelites go?" And all his officials are too scared to remind him that it was his decision and there was a very good reason why they let the Israelites go. But they're realizing this is really quite a problem. Pharaoh's going, "You idiots! Who is going to finish building my pyramids now?" And the rest of the officials say, "Well, he's kind of got a point. I had to bring my own cattle in from the field last night. There were no slaves to do it for me." Another one goes, I even had to make my own breakfast this morning. Can you imagine?" And so they think, okay, well, what are we going to do? And then suddenly, in the middle of the bunker, the chief spy pops up, and everyone jumps and goes, "Oh, how did you get there?" And he's this kind of very sneaky, beaky figure. And he says, "Your Majesty, I've got some good news for you. I've got the grid reference for where the Israelites are camped, and they're completely lost. They're walking around in circles. They don't know where they're going, and they're trapped. You've got a million untrained, defenseless slaves in the middle of a desert. If you take 20 chariots, you can round them up, you can kill any ringleaders you like, make an example of them, and you'll bring the rest of them home as slaves. It'll be dead easy." And Pharaoh bangs his fist on the table and says, "No way. No way am I taking 20 chariots. I'm going to take 600 chariots. I'm going to take the whole army. Get every chariot we have. I want the most elite regiments on this. No mistakes this time. No second chances for them. We are going to bring them home. We're going to do this properly." And so they head out, and the scene shifts back to the side of the Red Sea. And it's a really lovely spot, and the kids are splashing around. They've never seen the sea before. They're splashing in the surf, and Mum's saying, "Be careful, be careful. Have you got your sun cream on, darling?" And it's a beautiful spot. Everyone's having a bit of a rest. Any military person could tell you this is just a dreadful spot. There's nowhere for a million people to run. They're absolutely cornered. And Shem, again, he's the first to see it. There's a dust cloud on the horizon. And Dad, and he says, "Dad, what's that?" And Ben turns to his friend Josh, who's one of the elders of Israel, and he says, "Is that what I think it is?" And inexplicably, Josh grins and he says, "Yes. Yes, it is." And Ben looks around and says, "There is nowhere to run. I haven't got any weapons on me. There's nowhere to hide. Where am I going to take the kids? What are we going to do? I'm not going back. I can't go back. We're just going to be slaughtered here. We haven't got a chance. How long have we got?" And Josh grins again and he says, 20 minutes, I'd say, at the speed they're traveling. And everyone else around them is starting to notice too now. They're getting a bit edgy. And Ben says, "Why are you grinning? How are you grinning? This is a death trap." And Josh says, "Yes. Yes, it is. Not for us, It will be a death trap for the Egyptians. And Moses gets to his feet. And Judy, would you read to us what he says, verses 10 to 14?
As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone. Let us serve the Egyptians'? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only be still."
I take it that must have been the hardest thing those Israelites ever did in their lives. Can you imagine just standing there and watching the Egyptians come towards you? They're 25 minutes out, they're 20 minutes out, they're 15 minutes out, they're 10 minutes out, they're 7 minutes out. There is nowhere to run, there is nowhere to hide. You have just got to stand there. And every instinct, all the adrenaline going through your body is saying, fight or flight, get ready to fight, get ready to run away. And you can't do either of them. There's nothing for you to do. You just have to stand and wait. And the Egyptians get closer and closer, 7 minutes out, and they're about to get completely slaughtered. And Moses, this is the point at which Ben gets really scared. Moses says, "Advance. You've got a million people in front of the sea. Where are they going to advance to?" Moses has completely lost the plot. It's just terrifying. That is exactly what it looked like was not going to happen. There was no way for the Israelites to go. There was nowhere for them to go. Moses has flipped. He's told them to advance, and they're standing in front of a sea. What on earth are they going to do? Judy, would you read for us verses 15 to 22?
Then the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots and horsemen." Then the angel of the Lord, who had been traveling in front of Israel's army, withdrew and went behind them. The pillar of cloud also moved from in front and stood behind them, coming between the armies of Egypt and Israel. Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to one side and light to the other, so that neither went near the other all night long. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left.
Isn't that amazing? Can you imagine Ben telling that to his grandkids? We could see the Israelites coming. They were close enough. We could see the Egyptians coming. We could see the red mist in their eyes. They were absolutely mad. We were about to be slaughtered. And then just right on cue, thank you very much. There we go. The smoke machine. Oh, I was so excited about that moment. Never mind, might come back on in a bit. Right on cue, the pillar of cloud swings around and a pillar of fire, and it puts itself between the Egyptians and us. And there's this massive confusion. It's getting dark. It's late evening. That wouldn't have been a problem to the Egyptians. That's the perfect time to have an attack at last light. But at that very moment, the Egyptians are blocked off. And God does something amazing. See, what could the Israelites have done if they were caught by the side of the Red Sea? Let's
Let's have a think. Okay, how hard? I mean, we're not a million people. There's quite a lot of us. How hard can we blow? Can you blow hard enough that I could feel it on my hands? Just have a go. Everyone, 3, 2, 1. Can we have a big blow? I think I might have felt something. There might have been a slight breeze on my hands, right? So maybe a million people could have stood there, and if they blowed, do you think that would have pushed back the waters? Okay, what if they'd been really organized and they'd come with a hairdryer and they pointed it at the waters? Do you think that would have pushed back the waters? No, okay. If they can try to rescue themselves, maybe they've got another plan. Okay, we're going to get through the waters. I remember what I packed. Someone really organized. You know the kind of guy who always packs everything, packs the kitchen sink? He thinks to himself, I remembered. I brought my leaf blower. All right, here we go. Let's try that on the waters. I'm having a bad morning. There we go. All right. Do you think that would be enough to push back the Red Sea? All right. What's it going to take? It's going to take God stepping in with this massive wave, and it pushes, this massive wind comes up, and it opens up this tunnel through the water. And you know when you go to an aquarium and you walk underneath all the water, you see the sharks swimming over your head, that kind of thing. I think it must have been a bit like that, but without the plastic. And can you imagine as the kids walking, you know what the kids were doing, don't you? They were walking through putting their hands in the water. And can you imagine all the mums going, stop it, you might break the magic. And imagine Josh and one of the marshals as he helps the family down into the water saying, look, relax. This is completely safe. It's not magic. It's not some kind of spell. This is God. He is going to keep us completely safe. And Ben walking through just, I don't know, I guess none of them could swim, could they? How would they have learned to swim? That just absolutely terrified. The kids loving it. And mum and dad get out the other side and they're just shaking with relief and they're through the waters and they're safe and they're on the far bank. And over the course of a night, a million people come through the waters. And just in this extraordinary moment, it looks like they're going to be all right. And that the last of the marshals are coming down into the water. Josh and their friend Joe, the elders of Israel, are kind of, they can see them in the rear guard, just walking through, just smiling, just enjoying the moment. And then they realize dawn is coming. And the sun is just rising. And they hear this chant from the Egyptians. They're going, rah, rah, rah. They're just really posh. And then they realize, no, it's dawn. They're calling on the sun god, Ra. They think he's come to their aid. And these two pillars of cloud are moving out the way as if Ra has just kind of made them move. And the Egyptians who have been frustrated all night, they are madder than a wasp nest that's been poked, come out. And we come back. We got the two kings here. I should have put this flat up a moment ago. You've got the king who rides a chariot. That's Pharaoh. You've got this other king, the Lord, Yahweh, who we've met in the book of Exodus over the last few weeks, who rides the wind, who rides the waves, as the psalm puts it. And the two are now in a direct competition. And Pharaoh is heading down towards the tunnel. And the archer and his archers on the back of the chariot just trying to get their aim right. And they're just coming within a shot of Joe and Josh at the back. And the family on the back are now panicking. They're screaming at them to get out the tunnel. Run, get out. And they're terrified because if that tunnel is still open, well then they can just come straight on through there. It doesn't matter which side of the river you die on. You're still going to die if the Egyptians catch you. And at that very moment, the wheels quite literally come off Pharaoh's plan. Judy, would you be happy to read us verse 23 to 29?
The Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea. During the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and cloud at the Egyptian army and threw it into confusion. He made the wheels of their chariots come off so that they had difficulty driving. And the Egyptians said, "Let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen." Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing towards it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived. But the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground and with a wall of water on their right and on their left.
I love that. Can you imagine? You've got this vast number of defenseless, untrained, helpless Israelites trapped, and you've got the most powerful military force in the world coming down on them. You've got the multi-million pound army, the equivalent of all the kind of tank regiments bearing down on them. This is like Dunkirk escalated up goodness knows how many times, and not one Israelite dies and not one Egyptian survives. And so as they stand there and the debris starts washing ashore, you can imagine Ben trying to cover his kids' eyes, saying, "Kids, don't look, don't look." And Sarah saying, "No, kids, it's okay to look. Look, there's Pharaoh's helmet washed up on the shore. That man drowned my three little brothers when they were babies. Look at what's happened to him now. That is exactly what's happened to him. That is what happens when you try to fight the true and living God." And the question comes, who gets the glory? Now, it wasn't easy for the Israelites. They had to do something incredibly hard. They had to stand and do nothing, which is often the hardest thing to do. When we want to come up with a plan, when we try and want to fix things, they had to stand and do nothing. It wasn't easy, but how much glory do you get for standing still and doing nothing? All the glory goes to God. It is not a team effort. Judy, would you read verses 30 and 31 for us? Would that be all right?
That day, the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. And when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant.
Isn't that lovely? See, how does God's salvation work? It always works by faith alone. But because that is the most God-glorifying way that we could be saved. We have to trust that God is the one who is going to, if we are going to be saved, it has to be entirely God's work. Why? Because soli Deo Gloria, all the glory goes to him alone. I was wondering about whether to say that. I think 7 years ago, I don't think I'd even have admitted this to myself, but I think there was a large part of me that thought, do you know what, I think I'll be okay at being a vicar. I can preach a bit. I know I ought to pray. I quite like people. I'm not completely chaotically disorganized. Realizing that now. But I'll probably be all right as a vicar. You know, God is, aren't those people, good people at St. James, and isn't the Lord lucky to have me doing this? I feel just in so many ways, what's happened over the last 7 years, what's happened over the last few months in many ways has been just stripping away that idea that the glory goes to anyone other than Jesus. Because that is how God's salvation always works. We thought this morning about the king who rides the chariots, the king who rides the wind and the waves. I want us to close by thinking this Palm Sunday about the king who rides a donkey. Because 2,000 years ago, that man rides into Jerusalem, the Lord Jesus, the great King of Kings, not on a chariot, not on a war horse, on a donkey, on his own. He goes to the cross on his own. All the glory goes to him as he goes towards that death trap. Can you imagine Satan, all the forces of evil around the universe, rubbing their hands in glee? This is a death trap. This is the end. We've got Jesus, he's caught. And in the wisdom of the sovereign God who works in weakness and brokenness and helplessness, it was a death trap. Not for the Lord Jesus, but for all those who stood opposed to him. As he dies at the cross on his own, all the glory goes to him. And to him alone. And Paul picks this language up in 1 Corinthians 10. I won't go into it particularly this morning, but I'll read these two verses from 1 Corinthians chapter 10, where Paul talks about what happened at the Red Sea as a baptism. I don't want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud and that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. So what has happened? If you are someone who has been baptized, what does that symbolize? It symbolizes that you have gone down into the waters of judgment as a slave. and you have come out the other side set free. Why? Because the Lord Jesus, the great King of Kings, the King who rides the wind and the waves, the King who rides the donkey, went down into the waters of judgment and chaos and was submerged under them, that we might rise to new life with him. Amen.